Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! Washington Babylon, muckraker Alexander Coburn takes us on a whirlwind tour of his new book on power and evil in the nation's capital.
It's a bipartisan onslaught. We basically show there isn't a lesser of two evil and a greater of two evil. There's evil, so to speak. And if you're going to have politics, then you've got to understand what the evil is all about. That's the text of the book.
And Archer Daniels Midland, supermarket to the world and cash register to Congress, presidential candidates, and the media. We'll take a closer look at ADM and its CEO, Duane Andreas, with two investigative journalists. All this coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now!, of course, the only daily election show in public broadcasting. Well, it's no surprise Bob Dole and President Clinton wrapped up all three primaries yesterday in Washington, D.C., Indiana, and North Carolina. In North Carolina, former Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gantt wasted no time kicking off what he called Helms-Gantt 2, the rematch with Republican Senator Jesse Helms that he's wanted for 6 years. Within minutes of defeating political newcomer Charlie Sanders in the Democratic primary yesterday, a beaming, dancing Gantt urged Helms to come home to North Carolina and debate the issues. "Don't hide Jesse behind those 30-second TV commercials," said Gantt, who narrowly lost to Helms in 1990 after enduring attack ads that accused him of backing racial quotas. Joining me in this studio is Alexander Coburn. He's co-author with Ken Silverstein of a new book called Washington Babylon. They also co-edit Counterpunch in Newsweekly here in Washington. Well, following the North Carolina primary, I thought it would be a good chance to start off this conversation about your book by touching on the Republican incumbent from North Carolina, Senator Jesse Helms. You write about a former staff member of Helms. She was one of the most powerful staffers on the Hill, Debbie DeMoss. Tell us a little about her.
Yes, or Death Squad Debbie, as she used to be sometimes known around Washington. We do have a section of our book on her and on the great man Helms himself. She was very, very important, particularly in the late 80s. She had very, very close contacts with d'Aubuisson in El Salvador. And actually, in many ways, I think, was the driving force in the overthrow of Noriega. Noriega had used some CIA materials to spread low stories about DeMoss, who's, by the way, now married to a Honduran general and is living down in Central America, I believe. But she got mad at Noriega and really led the charge against him, which finally led to his present rather reduced circumstances in a federal prison in the United States. So we deal with DeMoss and also with her brother, who she comes from a very conservative, very, very rich family. So she's one of the figures that I think don't often get into the public eye. You know, influential figures on the Hill, these staff people that we put in the book.
You know, I think people might be more familiar with the DeMoss family in another way. If people watch CNN or other networks, they see ads that are fiercely anti-choice, and there were a new genre of ads. Instead of showing fetuses that were ripped apart, they show women longing for the children they didn't have. And at the end, there's always the slogan, "Life, what a beautiful choice." And these were considered revolutionary, and the anti-choice movement really turned the movement around because of the positive message they were putting out. That was put out by the DeMoss Foundation. I actually saw the whole family at a major anti-choice event in New York that raised millions for the anti-choice movement, a number of congresspeople and politicians there. That's how I know the DeMoss family.
There you go.
What about Jesse Helms?
Oh, there's a certain irony here. The other day, the Nation magazine, which I do a regular column, Beat the Devil, had a big story about Helms in which they attacked him strongly for trying to cut AID funding for AID, USAID, you know, the Agency for International Development, which is part of the State Department. The money was being designated to go to AFIELD, which is the American Independent Labor Development outfit that's basically big labor and the CIA organizing to undercut independent unions abroad. Actually, I was on Helms' side in that one because Helms, who doesn't want to give any money to USAID because he detests foreign aid in general, was trying to cut it back. I think that was quite right. And the nation was plaintively saying, please release the money, and what a beast Jesse Helms was. So it shows that there are certain ironies in some of these left-right divisions.
Well, doesn't it show that things are really breaking down now in a lot of ways, that you have Jesse Helms talking about cutting off aid, which, of course, means cutting off aid to places like, for example, Indonesia?
Yeah, Indonesia, or, you know, the leading recipient, of course, Israel and Egypt. Yes, I mean, you'd be on the Helms side in a lot of that stuff. The book tries to show all the time, the Washington Babylon, that it's a bipartisan onslaught. We basically show there isn't a lesser of two evil and a greater of two evil. There's evil, so to speak. And if you're going to have politics, then you've got to understand what the evil is all about. That's the text of the book.
What about the lobbyists? You talk about 80,000 lobbyists in Washington. Now, that may shock people outside the Beltway. 80,000 lobbyists?
Yep. There they are in all their massed ranks. We call them the fourth branch of government. And, of course, you know, well, this is no disclosure on our part. You have the lobbyists writing the bills openly. You're writing bills, you know, openly dictating the language to their people. Packwood, you remember in the great Packwood furore before he finally left, he actually records what he really wanted to do when he grew up and stopped being a U.S. senator was to become a lobbyist, which he finally did. He regarded that as an ascent into a higher sphere.
Do you think that a lot of the more, considered liberal publications are missing this breaking down, really, in many ways, where the right and left that have been traditionally aligned, especially in relation to the Democratic Party, that this is simply being missed?
I think so. I think a lot of the way people see the lineup, a lot of presentation of politics this year, for example, in The Nation, where they had a cover the other day, you know, was sort of cheering and saying the House is going to be recaptured by the Democrats with a picture of a little donkey with wings flying, angels' wings flying up, or In These Times or Mother Jones, all those outfits, you know, constantly present it as like virtue is now waiting in the wings to return to power in the Congress, which is absolutely ludicrous. So when you look at what has actually happened, you know, when the Democrats were in the first 2 years of Clinton's administration and what policies they subscribe to and the people who back them. And this leads to tremendous illusions about what politics can achieve unless you really try and change things around. You've got to be honest about these things. I think particularly this year, and I hope this book will do something to change this, you've got to be realistic, whether it be in the field of recognizing which lobbyists, corporate lobbyists, are paying for these Democratic politicians, or the role of the green groups, you know, which we deal a lot with, and how they really lie brazenly about what the Clinton environmental record is because they're hand in glove with the Democratic Party.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because certainly this is a major issue for people around the country who consider groups like the World Wildlife Fund, groups like the Natural Resources Defense Council, as out there on the front line fighting for the environment.
Well, all you have to do, which we record in this chapter, is to look what happened during the NAFTA fight. Here was the major fight, at the beginning of the Clinton regime. And with the exception of the Sierra Club, the green groups, whether you're World Wildlife, National Wildlife Federation, NRDC, National Resources Defense Council, came out with ringing endorsements of NAFTA, the NAFTA agreement, and saying that they'd got these famous environmental side agreements, which everybody knew then, and now they admit to be a total fraud. And they said NAFTA will be good for the environment. And the head of NRDC, Adams, said, we were the people who broke the back of environmental opposition to NAFTA. That's all you need to know. This has happened time and again. There was a bunch of ads last year from environmental groups saying, thank you, Mr. President, for saving the environment. This was actually when Clinton had actually, in the budget revision, specifically made it impossible to challenge mandated logging in the Pacific Northwest and across the country. The level of hypocrisy in this is complete. The press, the mainstream press, we write a bit about it, really doesn't cover environmental politics at all, but they're enormously important. Right now, you've got this scam where both parties know perfectly well, Gingrich and Clinton know perfectly well, that most Americans really want a clean environment. They don't want the place to be trashed. And there they are, both pretending they're friends of the environment, that they want the Endangered Species Act to survive and so forth. But, of course, they don't.
We're talking to Alexander Coburn, and he's a columnist for The Nation, writes the column Beat the Devil. He's also co-author of the new book Washington Babylon. He's written it with Ken Silverstein. He also, with Ken Silverstein, puts out a biweekly newsletter called Counterpunch around politics. Well, what can people do then? People who care a great deal about the environment, what do you propose? What do you think is the route to take?
Well, I think it's the route that actually sometimes people on the right take, which is to stand your ground. I mean, this is a good example. For example, there was a race in Oregon. We have this in the book, between Wyden, the Democrat, and was it Smith?
Who is running again, yes.
Who is now running again, that's right. And Wyden, for a brief while, there was an environmental candidate called Lou Gold. Now, Lou Gold was persuaded by the sort of environmentalists in Oregon to stand down. They said, oh, Lou, if you go on running, you'll take votes away from Wyden and we'll get the beastly Republican in. Well, Gold did stand down. Wyden made endless speeches saying he wanted more logging, even more logging than there was before. And then after he won, with the help of the environmentalists, crucial 1% or 2% margin that they gave him, he announced that he spoke for all the people of Oregon, and he had to listen closely to the chainsaw gang. In other words, and Wyden will be just as bad, if not worse, than Smith. The moral of that story being, I think, where you can make a difference, an environmental candidate, you should stand your ground. You say, well, if the Democrat's going to lose, tough. If the Democrat took a good position, maybe we'd think again. In other words, we're at that moment in the corruption of American political life where you cannot go on playing this scam about the lesser of two evils. And that's the moral of this book.
Take us on a visit to the Pentagon and the national security state. In your chapter in the book, Washington Babylon, the first page has a picture of Colin Powell sitting with Senator Phil Graham and ABC's Rune Arledge.
What we do there is to show, in the Pentagon chapter, we actually trace, you know, the successful defensive actions fought by the pork barrelers at the Pentagon to save the really important bits of their budget, which, of course, is for the arms companies, now always very politely called the aerospace the defense establishment. The arms companies keep them pumped up with R&D to go on producing weapons. You get the tilt of funding in the Pentagon budget is very interesting now. You do have units, you know, which don't have gas for their trucks, but the appropriation going for the big arms companies goes up and up and up and up. We really go back to the early 70s and show how the Pentagon has successfully fought off various attempts to reduce its budget, and we show how they've used various levels of threat. I think what we've got now coming up is, you know, a great deal of use of the impending China threat. That China, by the early third millennium, will be in a position to reduce the United States to rubble unless the Pentagon gets shoveled another $100 billion.
Perhaps the greatest ally of the Pentagon is the press. I mean, if people understood the portion of the budget that the Pentagon takes up, I think their estimates between, 40 and 50-something percent, if you deal with interest paid on back loans, etc., perhaps people in this budget-cutting atmosphere would be looking at the largest portion of the budget.
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely, but it's immune to challenge. That writing about the Pentagon has declined markedly. I mean, the Pentagon hasn't declined markedly, but writing in the press about it, I mean, when the Cold War was at its height, you know, it was regarded as a very good career path for journalists. You know, if you were at the Pentagon, you were a big muckety-muck. But now, defense correspondents, they're almost as low on the pecking order as, let's say, that most newspapers don't even have a labor correspondent, or most TV networks. They barely could find their way to the AFL-CIO headquarters. So here you have three areas now we've discussed. One is the Pentagon, one is the environmental beat, one is the labor beat, and the mainstream press virtually have nobody on any of these beats.
Let's talk about the Central Intelligence Agency as we move from the Pentagon. Just this week, William Colby found dead, believed drowned, near his summer house. William Colby, of course, the director of Central Intelligence under Carter and Ford.
Colby's role particularly in Vietnam, was absolutely infamous, of course. You know, not only did he oversee the Phoenix program of assassination of communist suspects, some 20,000, but even more significantly, I think, back in 1961, when he was in Vietnam for the agency, he was the one who was saying, yes, the elections that got Diem elected really did show massive support by the people. And all of this was read with great excitement by the Kennedy people and was one of the reasons why they escalated in Vietnam. He had a lot to answer for. And then, of course, in the early 70s, he almost became a liberal hero because after he leaked to Seymour Hersh the fact that James Angleton, the head of counterintelligence in the CIA, had been wiretapping Americans and maintaining dossiers on Americans, which, of course, was counter to the CIA charter. And then once the stories had appeared in Seymour Hersh's byline in the New York Times in, December of 1974, he said to Angleton, well, look at this, you unfired him. And people said that was very good. And then he testified in Congress, of course, about some of the misdeeds of the agency. And liberals thought he was, on the whole, a good guy. And this, after he was fired by Ford, and then he came out for the nuclear freeze and said the Pentagon could be, the budget could be cut, even more of a liberal hero. But in fact, what Kelby did, I think, very successfully was get the CIA really off the hook at that Watergate moment by saying not that the CIA was integrated into government acts of criminality, but by saying there were rogue officers within the CIA who had done very bad things. Well, there's a huge difference. When the Pike Committee on the House side did its report on the agency, there was a lot of alarm because the Pike Commission went a different way. They just talked about how integral the criminality was to government policy. And, of course, the Pike Committee report in draft form was then leaked via Dan Shore, actually, which is why he was fired from CBS, because he tried to shift the blame onto Leslie Stahl, was leaked to the Village Voice when I was on The Voice, actually. And The Voice published it. And then, of course, the CIA used that to say, we can't tell anything to Congress because Congress is a bunch of blabbermouths and it'll end up on the front page of a newspaper or in the Village Voice. Actually, probably the CIA leaked the document to achieve that effect.
Now, today we have the director of Central Intelligence, John Deutsch, and he has proposed increasing the powers of the Central Intelligence Agency. In fact, using, once again, or people might say this has happened over more time than people may like, using journalists and priests to go undercover.
Oh, well, I think they've always done that. This idea that they don't use journalists or there's a rule about not using journalists is absolutely preposterous. I think they've always used journalists, and there's never been a moment when they haven't.
Explain what you mean when you say use journalists.
Oh, well, you have a journalist who you might say, well, if you go to such and such a place, would you look for such and such, or ask, and then you debrief the journalist later on. I mean, that'd be one way of doing it. I'm sure it happens all the time. And then, you know, you get the journalists to go in various areas, and, you know, journalists can go to areas where maybe the direct CIA person can't. It's interesting, by the way, about Deutsch. I was just looking in the book. He actually still has an interest in a firm in Cambridge, even though he's a government official. So you have a government official with a private enterprise, which is doing very well under government contracts.
Is it biotechnology firm?
I was actually just trying to find. No, it's not biotech. Actually, it's more of a it's mapping. Actually, more. I was just quickly glancing in the book.
Well,
here we are. Yes, he and Bill Perry have a firm called Cambridge Research Associates. In 1995, this firm received an $800,000 contract to develop 21st century ground aircraft. The three men were the first top Defense Department officials allowed to hold investments in a military contractor, even though they have authority over billions in procurement money. There you have it. That's not been exactly a big item in the press, has it?
And didn't John Deutsch also play a key role in the Martin Marietta Lockheed merger?
Yeah, I think he did.
When he was a number two man to Perry in the Defense Department. Finally, Alexander Coburn, we have to wrap up right now. How would you like people to, how would you summarize Washington Babylon in a nutshell?
I think Washington Babylon is exciting. It's funny. Most muckraking books about Washington, you know, you get sort of buried in the sludge of criminality. But we have, I vividly in mind was that book, Hollywood Babylon, where there's photographs to look at, captions to look at. We have asides in the book where you get into a little smaller narrative. So I think what people really seem to like the book. I'm really pleased. And they say that the book is fun to read, although in a way, it's alarming, it's depressing, but it's also fun because it's a very vivid portrait of the corruption of a political culture and exactly the details of that corruption, not just the broad outlines, but you know exactly all the little crevices, the pits in the visage of government in the nation's capital today.
Alexander Coburn, co-author of the book Washington Babylon. He also writes with Ken Silverstein the newsletter Counterpunch. You're listening to Democracy Now! Coming up in the last segment of the show, a look at Archer Daniels Midland. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the daily show that focuses on the last presidential election of the century. The Cold War is over, but is America now at war with itself? It seems as though Americans are increasingly dividing along racial, class, gender, and ideological lines. Abraham Lincoln warned us, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." A new book called A House Divided looks at six belief systems struggling for America's soul. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky spoke with the author, Mark Gerzon, co-founder of the Rockefeller Foundation project, The Common Enterprise, a network of community efforts to rebuild common ground.
Mark Gerzon, author of A House Divided, subtitled Six Belief Systems Struggling for America's Soul, just published by Tarcher Putnam. Mark, welcome to Pacifica Radio and Democracy Now!
Good to be with you.
Mark, you're not the first person to have tried to divide America into analyzable segments. We have the think tanks like the RAND Corporation, the Times Mirror Center for People in the Press, who try to tell us what people they think are thinking and how they approach matters. Why did you think another way was necessary this time to analyze belief systems?
I thought that there was an important challenge that we face as Americans, which is to start looking underneath the conflicts that are tearing us apart and see what are the belief systems that are making us act the way we do. None of the other projects or pollings that you did took that as their task. They tried to lump all Americans according to their values or their value systems. What I did was I took the belief systems that are struggling for America's soul, and by that I meant the belief systems that are behind almost all the headlines that are in the papers every day. No one else has done that.
Early on in the book, you talk about your experience going around the country and doing this book, speaking with more than 100 people, saying that from time to time you'll see people get together who seem to be on opposite sides of an issue. The opportunity, I'm quoting from you here, appears to be there for people to reach out to each other, to speak from their hearts, to rediscover their common bond. People see the opportunity, lean towards it, and then turn away. Why do they turn away?
I think people turn away from the opportunity of finding common ground with an adversary because we always define ourselves through our adversaries. This country has defined itself in its opposition to Hitler and then its opposition against this former Soviet Union. We don't have those enemies anymore. And so now we're wondering, well, how do we define ourselves? And what we're finding is that people are defining themselves by hating other Americans the way they used to hate the Soviet Union. I mean, Oliver North, who ran for the Senate in Virginia, put it this way. He said, "The enemy's not in Moscow anymore. It's across the river in Washington."
Of course, some people thought the enemy was him.
Absolutely. Well, that's the nature of the belief systems. There are six belief systems, and I think they amount to civil wars.
Okay, let's get into those belief systems for our listeners right away. They all have Latinate names. By the way, why did you choose to call them things like patria and et cetera?
Because if I called a state the religious right, it would offend people, and people would immediately get an image of what I was talking about. I didn't want that, because people have prefixed ideas about all these belief systems. They either like them or they dislike them. And I wanted people to approach them with an open mind, so I gave them names like a state, patria, corporatia, et cetera.
Okay, patria, corporatia, dicia, media is an easy one, gaia, and officia. Let's talk for a moment about dicia, since that's the one where you have characterized part of it as being centered around minority radio stations, which is what these are, the ones you're appearing on. In this, you paint, I thought, a rather gloomy picture of people who are disaffected at the system, angry at the system, feel that they have no chance within the system, and that this goes way back to the founding of this nation and is a bedrock concept of our country.
I portray a belief system that's based on America being exploitative and oppressive, and it's the belief system I'm looking at. My own history is as a radical, as a draft resister, as somebody who's always been part of progressive movements. So I'm obviously sympathetic to the cause. What I'm critiquing here in this chapter and in the other five are the belief systems that make people act in a way that I don't think is always in their best interest or in the country's best interest. And the only reason I portray it as bleak is because when you're part of a belief system, a self-reinforcing belief system, you're not in a position to learn or change. And I find people locked in any belief system, whether it's a leftist one or a rightist one, to be self-defeating.
Are people really locked into their belief systems in this country, or do they just adopt them from time to time in conflictual situations?
I found a lot of people that were locked into them. And I almost see it as almost like experiencing life through the prison bars of your belief system, but you don't know that it's you're in a cage. I mean, just to speak personally, I was very proud of my radicalism in the 60s and my draft resistance and so forth. It was only while researching this book that I had to come face to face with the fact that I had a lot of biases and prejudices about other Americans. Now, because I hung out with people like myself, I was never forced to confront them. So the fact that I feared the religious right, well, no one ever confronted me about that. The fact that I had stereotypes about corporate capitalists, well, no one ever confronted me about that. We all hated the same people. But this book forced me, since I spent time with the religious right and since I spent time with corporate conservatives, it forced me to confront my own biases and prejudices. And I realized that I had a lot of humbling to do myself. So I don't write this book from a holier-than-thou attitude, telling people to move beyond their prejudices. I had to do it myself.
Well, one of the things I do in life is one of the things that you just did. I travel around and I talk to people with whom I may have total disagreement, and I generally find a lot of them to be nice guys, nice women, people you can talk to up to a certain point, people you can have dinner with, people who interview you, people who invite you into their homes. But then you come up against a barrier eventually if you step out of your role or my role as reporter or interviewer and you really start to exchange where you're at with them. You're not with them at all. But that doesn't preclude you from having a certain fundamental human connection with them. So what?
You're saying what's the importance of that human connection?
Yeah.
I think the importance of the human connection is that if you have that human connection, you will not send mail bombs to them. If you have that human connection...
I can't imagine sending a mail bomb to anybody under any circumstances.
Right, but I'm saying... But that's because you have a human connection with people than who you're different than. I call you a new patriot. I define patriotism in the book as not being, I'm right, you're wrong, which is the title of James Carville's book. I define it not as love it or leave it, which is what the right wing threw at us during the Vietnam War. I define patriotism in a house divided as meaning reaching out to someone different from yourself who represents a different ethnic or racial or ideological group and building common ground with them. I believe that that's the kind of patriotism that will keep America together in the 21st century. I think without that kind of patriotism, we will disintegrate and fragment as a culture.
Well, suppose my next-door neighbor is a nice guy who lends me his lawnmower and our kids play together, and someday I walk into his house and I see neo-Nazi paraphernalia around and a Confederate flag on the floor. You know, what am I supposed to do about that?
I sure would talk to him about it. I sure would talk to him about it, and given my politics, I would try to talk him out of it. But you have a basis as his neighbor, as somebody who's, you know, exchanged lawn equipment and whose kids have played together. You have a basis for talking to each other. You won't go in there and start screaming at him and calling him names.
No, of course not.
Right, and that's what's happening in American politics today.
But you're distinguishing, see, the thing that I'm trying to get at here is you're making a case about human interaction, and then you're talking about politics, which is something completely different, as it's practiced now, isn't it?
Well, see, I think there's a connection between human interaction and politics. If I am running
There is or there should be.
I think there is and should be. that if we have between candidates, as we have today, the notion that you get into office by destroying the other person's character, by assassinating them, you know, their reputation, what happens, the net effect of that is that the people lose faith in their elected leaders. And now, you know, in the 60s, we wanted people to lose faith in their elected leaders. We didn't think they deserved our faith. Well, we've succeeded beyond our wildest dreams. In 1966, 40% of Americans said they had a lot of faith in their elected leaders. Today, it's 7%. All right, now what? Now that we're down into single digits, and we've destroyed our faith in our elected leaders, and we feel estranged from each other, now what? To me, there's only one way out of this single-digit distrust, and that's to start building common ground with people who we find different than ourselves. And that's what you do professionally. That's what New Patriots all across the country are doing.
New Patriots is what this movement is called, as you make clear in your book, Mark Gerzon, House Divided. I wonder how those New Patriots are going to, if at all, perhaps it's too soon for them to do so, how they're going to manifest themselves in something like the 1996 electoral campaign.
Well, I think one of the ways they're manifesting themselves already is saying the pox on both your houses. They're saying, we don't like the way you campaign, and they're tuning out. They're tuning out, and they're looking for somebody else who's going to campaign in a different way. Unfortunately, they've been given some very bad alternatives, like Ross Perot. You know, I'm not interested in voting for an egomaniac myself. What I'm interested in, and I'm part of something called the Campaign for Common Ground, which is challenging candidates to start running a different kind of campaign. Although I'm a Democrat by inclination and practice, I'm interested in challenging Democrats and Republicans alike to run for office in a different way. And when you poll American people and you run focus groups across the country, as we have, we find that Americans across the spectrum, from the right to the left, want very similar kind of campaigns. They want people treating each other with decency, focusing on the issues, using less negative campaigning, etc. And when candidates step forward and do that, I think the American people will respond.
When candidates step forward and do that, I think that when might be changed to an if, because I don't frankly see any sign of it happening on any massive scale this time within the two-party movement. Now, outside the two major parties, you have a whole different approach in many areas, in the Greens, the Peace and Freedom Party, et cetera, and various other parties. Are you saying necessarily that alternative party movements are where this is going to happen, or do you still have some hope for the two major party system?
I only have a hope for the two major party system if the American people start challenging the way they campaign against each other, because they are locked in belief systems. What my book is about is the way belief systems have paralyzed us. And they have. If you spend time on the Hill, as I have, I spoke on the Hill recently to both Democrats and Republicans, and there are a number of congressmen and women who are saying, I don't want to play this party lockstep game. This is not the way to govern a country. This is not the way to do the people's business. And yet that's what the party leadership is trying to foster. They're still trying to foster this party loyalty and then turning each other into the enemy. And, I mean, I've talked to many audiences that are partisan for the Democrats, but they're even beginning to sense that being partisan for one side against the other is not going to get what we want for our constituencies unless they start to work together in a more constructive way.
A number of years ago, you wrote a book, which I remember, called The Whole World is Watching, which was a book about the protest movement of the 60s. And that title, The Whole World is Watching, and the whole philosophy that people had in those years, in fact, the chant outside the Democratic Convention in 1968 was exactly that, the whole world's watching, as the police were beating up anti-war protesters. How has that changed, do you see, from 1968, let's say, to 1996, where the whole world may still be watching, but if you chant outside the whole world is watching, trying to shame people who are doing something like beating others up, nothing happens now. The whole world may be watching, but the whole world isn't acting.
Right.
And the assumption isn't even there anymore that they will.
Well, I tell the story in A House Divided of a community organizer who was trained in the Saul Alinsky model, who now runs something called the Consensus Organizing Institute out of Boston, Mike Eichler, one of the best community organizers in the country. And basically what he says is there's a limit to the social change you can accomplish through shame, that shame does not build community. Shame does not build common ground. What shame does is it shames the other side. It may make a short-run difference in their behavior. They may stop beating you. They may stop doing something. But shame is not the basis on which to build a relationship. And so what's happened since the 60s is a lot of the enmities that started in the 60s have simply gotten stronger. The fight between the culture and the counterculture has not only gotten stronger, but has started to splinter us into numerous subcultures that are still at war with each other. So the question is, how does one turn that around? Well, I can tell you in a family, since I was trained as a family therapist, among other things, in a family, you turn around shame by getting to feelings that are beneath the desire to shame and blame each other. And those are often feelings of hurt, of anger, of sorrow, of grief, deeper emotions that have to be worked through. And the work that I've done professionally, I've brought competing belief systems and cities together. And that's the process that they inevitably go through. They begin by finger-pointing and blaming the other person for being the source of their community's problems. And after months of work, where they get to is realizing that they've both had a role to play in it, and that the only way to work it through is to go to those deeper levels of emotion and not stay on the level of shame.
I think your analysis in this book and in this interview is correct, that the American people are looking for some alternative to the blame-shame game, I guess we could call it. But I see no sign, unfortunately, of the 1996 political campaign as it's being played out on the national level, that the parties are going to do anything other than what they always do, which is hire consultants, run a bunch of shaming, blaming ads on television, and turn off a lot of people, but then try to harvest the few votes of those who remain and will vote. In your book, I didn't get a sense that you thought the political system as such was necessarily the place that we can look for such change happening.
The seeds that I see in the culture now are not in the two-party system. The seeds that I see are primarily in grassroots community movements and individuals who have reached out and found common ground with somebody very different from themselves. The only way of organizing that politically is through something like, I think, what we're trying to do, which is the Campaign for Common Ground, where we're trying to get groups across the country to articulate the principles that they would like to govern campaigns and to take those principles to their candidates and say, either you run on a principled basis and work with us to do so on a bipartisan basis, or we're going to find other candidates who will. There is no alternative for the American people. My favorite analogy, since I'm a basketball fan and since I grew up in Indiana, is that if you had a basketball game where consistently there was no referee, somebody would foul somebody on the other team, and he'd notice that it worked. They didn't score.
I've played in games like that.
Yeah, and then if you don't have a referee, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to say, hey, that foul worked. I'll foul him worse the next time. And pretty soon, it's not basketball, it's brawling. That's what politics has become. So the question then is, who in the American political system is going to act as a referee? And I think there has to be a force that essentially puts aside its partisan belief systems and says, we are going to act as a referee. We may prefer the Democrat over the Republican, but our primary purpose here is to make sure there's a campaign that makes us proud to be involved in it and is good for our community. That's the force we need.
Mark, is there a place where people can get hold of the Campaign for Common Ground and learn more details other than reading your book, which I'm about to tell people about again?
Absolutely. They can write to the Campaign for Common Ground, Four Seasons Court, Suite 1418, Boston, Massachusetts, 02116.
Say it one more time.
The Campaign for Common Ground, Four Seasons Court, Suite 1418, Boston, Massachusetts, 02116.
His name is Mark Gerzon. He's co-founder of the Rockefeller Foundation Project The Common Enterprise and author of a new book, A House Divided, Six Belief Systems Struggling for America's Soul, published by Tarcher Putnam. Thank you, Mark Gerzon. I'm Larry Bensky for Pacifica.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nights in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the wars against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA. It's coming from the sorrow in the street, the holy places where the races meet. From the homicidal bitchin' that goes down in every kitchen to determine who will serve and who will eat. It's coming to America first, the cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery of change. And it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family's broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA. I'm sentimental, if you know what I mean. I love the country, but I can't stand the scene. And I'm neither left or right, I'm just staying home tonight, getting lost in that hopeless little screen. And I'm stubborn as those garbage bags that time cannot decay. I'm junk, but I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. Democracy is coming to the USA. Sail on. Sail on, O mighty ship of state. To the shores of need, past the reefs of greed, through the squalls of hate. Sail on. Sail on. Sail on.
Leonard Cohen's poem Democracy on Democracy Now! Next up, a look at Archer Daniels Midland. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the only broadcasting of the elections in a daily way from now until the elections. I'm Amy Goodman. Right now, we're going to take a look at Archer Daniels Midland, the largest agribusiness company in the Western world. It's also one of the biggest contributors to political campaigns to both Republican and Democratic candidates. ADM has been very savvy in spreading its political influence around. ADM chief Duane Andreas is a longtime friend of Bob Dole. And just last week, the Washington Post reported that Andreas has donated millions of dollars to the Red Cross since Elizabeth Dole has been at its helm. ADM is also a corporation that's under criminal investigation by the Justice Department for international price fixing. There hasn't been much coverage or discussion of ADM in public broadcasting, perhaps because ADM has spent several hundred thousand dollars a year underwriting National Public Radio, millions of dollars to McNeil Lehrer. They give also advertising, tremendous amount of advertising on ABC, NBC, CBS, Meet the Press, Face the Nation. This week with David Brinkley, you often see those advertisements. Well, today we're going to take this opportunity to talk about this agricultural conglomerate, the largest in the Western world. We're joined by two investigative reporters. Ron Henkoff is Chicago Bureau Chief for Fortune. He wrote a series of pieces on Archer Daniels Midland for Fortune magazine. And we're joined in the studio here in Washington by Dan Carney. He's a reporter currently with the Congressional Quarterly. He did a story in Mother Jones magazine about a year ago on Duane Andreas, the CEO and chair of the board of ADM. Why don't we begin with you, Dan? You're one of the few journalists who's ever gotten to interview Duane Andreas. Why don't you tell us who he is?
He's the chairman of ADM. He's a very interesting fellow. He grew up fairly modestly in Minnesota, and as a fairly young man came to be first the head of a company called Cargill, which is also another agribusiness company, and then he moved over to ADM. And over the last several decades, he's not only become the chairman of this agribusiness conglomerate, but he's very successfully contacted and influenced important politicians in Washington and even throughout the world. I mean, he had some pretty close ties with Gorbachev and a number of European leaders. So he might be the most politically connected CEO in the world.
What about his history here? Let's go back to Watergate days.
That's when he first started getting attention, or should I say notoriety. When I was investigating the company, I came across a deposition by Rosemary Woods, who was President Nixon's personal secretary. And she said one day that Andreas himself walked in the door of the White House carrying an envelope with $100,000 in cash in it, which back then was actually legal, but I guess it would raise all sorts of red flags if the chairman of a major company walks into the president's office and plops $100,000 of cash on the table. That money, Nixon asked her to put that in the White House safe, and it stayed there for about a year or so. And right about the time when President Nixon was getting in trouble over Watergate, he asked about the money, and she said, "Yeah, it's still there." And he asked that it be returned, presumably because he didn't want it, showing up at an inopportune moment.
What about the Watergate burglars?
Another This was easier to trace because it was in the form of a check, but it was found in an account of one of the Watergate burglars, a $25,000 check.
Were there ever criminal charges brought against Duane Andreas? Was he breaking any law here?
There was an investigation, and there was an indictment, as I recall, but he was never convicted for anything. So he's had a few skirmishes with the law, but never anything that's gotten into long-term trouble.
Well, why don't we jump up about 20 years? Ron Henkhoff, you've also been investigating Archer Daniels Midland. I assume Fortune's not getting too much advertising from ADM. But why don't you tell us about the investigation you've done into ADM, more related to its international price fixing and a criminal investigation that's going on today?
Well, this story really began almost a year ago now when FBI agents suddenly raided the headquarters of Archer Daniels Midland, which is in Decatur, Illinois, which is a medium-sized town in the middle of the state. And they carted away box loads of documents and visited the homes of executives in really kind of a dramatic B-movie fashion. And then it emerged a few days later that there had been secretly an informant working for the FBI, and not your normal kind of low-level informant, but a very high-ranking executive, in fact, probably the leading candidate to be the next president of ADM, and his name is Mark Whitaker. He's now 39. He was 38 at the time when this all broke, and it turned out that he had been working with the FBI for 2.5 years and secretly recording, audio taping, conversations within the company, and I think more interestingly, meetings outside the company with competitors, especially competitors from other countries, particularly Japan. And it was an investigation involving three products, all of them derived from corn. The most notorious one now is one that probably most people have never heard of, which is lysine, which is an ingredient that is used. It's added to animal feed, particularly poultry and pig feed, to help produce the growth of lean muscles. And basically, that investigation is ongoing. There is a lot of evidence on tape. He also helped the FBI arrange some videotapes of some of the meetings. And there were a series of about 15 meetings around the world over a period of 2.5 years. And that investigation is continuing, and nearly a year after the FBI raided the headquarters, there have been no indictments yet.
Do you think that has something to do with the power of ADM, not only in the media, so you don't hear any kind of drumbeat that might be proportionate to what we're talking about here, this international price-fixing scheme, but also because of the amount of money he gives to the Republican and the Democratic parties?
Well, certainly Duane Andreas and ADM have a lot of influence in Washington, but you have to understand that this case has been enormously complicated by the fact that Mark Whitaker, the informant I mentioned, turned out to have some problems with the law himself, and ADM revealed shortly after Whitaker's cover was blown and it was revealed that he was the whistleblower, that he had been, as they said, stealing money from the company. And they charged him with stealing $2.5 million and fired him. And subsequently, he admitted receiving money off the books as what he described as part of an illegal or illicit compensation scheme for senior executives. And he said it was approved by ADM management. ADM completely denies that they approved it. But that launched a whole separate investigation by another branch of the Justice Department, whereas the Antitrust Division is investigating the alleged price fixing. It's the fraud section of the criminal division that's investigating whatever kind of financial fraud was committed by Whitaker and whether others were involved in that. And so now you have two parts of the Justice Department, in a sense, at odds with each other. One looking into charges that were brought to it by ADM, and the other one looking into charges against ADM. And part of the problem is that the Justice Department isn't coordinating its investigations all that well. And then you have the one investigation where ADM has asked the Justice Department to look into the matters, where ADM has a lot of influence with the Justice Department. And so they can kind of use that as a vehicle to hold up the price-fixing investigation. So, yes, there's power, and I think that's the way ADM is exercising that power.
Well, Ron Hankoff, I have to commend you for your pieces in Fortune. Your piece with Mark Whitaker, just going through the story, read like a detective story. I remember seeing it on the stands last year, the cover, and I was completely engrossed in what was going on around the world. I believe Mark Whitaker has something like 1,600 hours of tapes of these are high-level meetings, secret meetings that ADM conducts with people around the world. I was most intrigued by one of the mottos that he said was ADM's, often repeated: the competitors are our friends, the customer is our enemy.
That's right. That was kind of what he described as the unofficial motto at the company. And, you know, I have asked ADM to comment before this interview with Whitaker was published, and after it's been published, I've asked ADM to comment specifically on all the allegations that Whitaker makes about his former employer. And basically, the company has been silent, and they've been silent on that point, on whether that phrase was used, and they've been silent on basically all the other allegations, although I have gotten some people to dispute some of what he says.
Let's talk about ethanol for a minute. Dan Carney, currently of Congressional Quarterly, did the investigation for Mother Jones. Senator Dole has been called Senator Ethanol, long championed ethanol. And while under the Bush administration, the EPA issued a waiver around ethanol, when it came to President Clinton, they too issued this waiver once they got quite a large sum of money from Duane Andreas and ADM. Tell us, first of all, what is ethanol used for?
Well, ethanol, quite simply, is alcohol. It's the form of alcohol that's drinkable, as opposed to methanol, which is the type of alcohol that you rub on your arm after a shot. Its primary use, though, is not as a beverage, but as either a direct mixture in gasoline to make something called gasohol, or as something manufactured into an additive that goes by the acronym of ETBE, which boosts the octane level of gasoline and also is a little bit cleaner than conventional gasoline. Everyone in Washington loves ethanol. As you mentioned, President Bush basically issued a waiver for ethanol. President Clinton couldn't get away with that because it's got environmental problems. And so what he did was he simply said that 30% of all of the gasoline sold in the most polluted cities, you know, Houston, Los Angeles, Denver, New York, had to have a renewable additive, and really the only additive on the market that qualifies is this additive made from ethanol. So he did this right at the same time that he got $100,000 in soft money from Andreas.
Now, of course, the ADM story continues. There are some just amazing connections. You have Bob Dole and Elizabeth Dole in their condominium in Bell Harbor, Florida. And they got this condominium from Duane Andreas, a subsidiary that owns that building. He, too, has an apartment condominium in this building. Mm-hmm. They got it for below market value. You have David Brinkley in a condominium in the same building. So you will have, on This Week with David Brinkley, an interview with Bob Dole from the porch of his condominium in the Duane Andreas complex. You have David Brinkley interviewing him, and then after the interview, you have a commercial for ADM Supermarket to the World. Incestuous?
Yeah, it's a kind of cozy relationship. And there are other people that live or have lived in that building. Robert Strauss, who is sort of the... Washington lawyer to the stars lives there. Tip O'Neill, when he was alive, he lived there. Howard Baker.
Speaker of the House.
Yeah, Howard Baker, former chief of staff, former Senate majority, and I believe minority leader, has a place there. So it's quite an example of how people in Washington can spend their spare time together.
And Robert Strauss is also a member of ADM's board.
Yeah, I should mention that.
Now, again, we don't hear too much about ADM in the media except when they're advertising on it. I was talking to Jeff Cohen yesterday, who's head of Fairness and Accuracy Reporting, FAIR, in New York. He's written quite a lot about ADM. He said, we have to be careful to note that you will have the networks occasionally mentioning ADM, for example, if there's an indictment or an investigation. But what they don't do is investigate. They don't do that affirmative approach, which they might do in other cases. So they can say, oh, yes, we mentioned that there's a criminal investigation. Do you find that that's the case, Dan Carney?
Oh, yeah. Now, the networks probably would say that it's too esoteric a topic. I've heard that with other subjects, too. I mean, right now there's a big controversy in Washington over giving free frequencies to broadcasters, billions of dollars worth of free spectrum space. And, kind of funny, the broadcasters haven't done a piece on it, and they say, well, it's too complicated, too esoteric.
It's complicated if you never hear about it.
Yeah.
Ron Henkhoff, what do you expect? What kind of impact will ADM have this year on the presidential elections or on congressional races? How do you think it'll play in?
Well, that's a very good question, because you have to wonder, why has the Justice Department taken so long to bring indictments, which all the sources I've talked to that there insist are still coming. And you have to wonder if indictments are brought, say, at the end of this summer, which is what the current estimate is, and then given the kind of typical legal maneuvering that takes place, if there is then a change of power and Bob Dole becomes president and this case then comes to trial or gets on the docket under a Bob Dole administration, you really do have to wonder what's going to happen then. But on the other hand, you can also say, and I think as you pointed out, that Andreas has given money to both political parties going way, way back. I mean, he was a big buddy of Hubert Humphrey, and he was pals with Thomas Dewey, who's the guy who ran against Harry Truman. I mean, this tradition of giving to both parties by Andreas, his relatives, and ADM itself goes way, way back. So it's hard to say which party is most in his debt here.
Well, we're going to continue to cover this story. We're going to cover it for Pacifica and all the community stations, and I guess we'll be filling a big void and maybe even pressing the networks to start to deal with this, not to mention public radio and public television. We want to thank you both for joining us. Dan Carney, reporter with Congressional Quarterly. His story appeared in Mother Jones about a year ago on Duane Andreas, CEO and chair of the board of ADM. We also want to thank Ron Henkhoff, Chicago bureau chief for Fortune magazine, whose pieces on Archer Daniels Midland have been very revealing and among the few. Thank you both very much, and we're going to continue this story on ADM. And we want to get your comments, and we also want to let you know you can get a copy of this show by calling the Pacifica Archives. You can purchase them by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Remember, Democracy Now! Is the daily election program brought to you by you, the listeners, and not brought to you by any supermarkets to the world. Democracy Now! Is produced, who are helping as well. You can write to us at 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. That's Democracy Now! Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Tomorrow, Noam Chomsky. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be right back.